Dame Hilary Mantel's Tudor trilogy is now complete. The first two books, Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies, each won the Man Booker in 2009 and 2012, respectively. And now, 8 years later, comes The Mirror and the Light, describing the final 4 years of Thomas Cromwell, who, having risen to the heights of earldom, finds Henry VIII turning on him at last, just as he did on Cromwell's mentor, Cardinal Wolsey. Mantel has written many other award-winning novels, The Giant O'Brien, Beyond Black, and a memoir, Giving Up the Ghost. But the Wolf Hall trilogy has been declared the greatest historical fiction accomplishment of the past decade, written by the greatest English prose writer of our time. I told Hilary Mantel I'd just finished the final instalment of the Wolf Hall trilogy, and I felt proper wrung out. How was she?
I suppose for me that stage passed quite a few months ago, you know, and I'm now in the thick of publication where, actually, even if you did feel wrung out, you're got to put a smile on your face.
I did have a smile on my face amidst the tears, actually, because it was terribly sad having been immersed in the life and thoughts of Thomas Cromwell for so long. Even his death...
That's good to know.
Even, you know, you knew that he was going to die, no spoiler alert required, but nevertheless it seemed to happen so suddenly, so suddenly.
Yes, that's the thing, because there's been an assumption about this book that it's all about Cromwell's fall, but actually it's about his rise and rise to increasing power and wealth. And then his fall, when it comes, is so sudden, and within a couple of months it's all over.
Why do you think Henry elevated Thomas Cromwell so, Earl of Essex, finally, only to destroy him?
Well, the people there at the time said, this is what Henry does. He never made a man, except he destroyed him afterwards. And I think with Cromwell, Henry wanted him back, you know. Henry really regretted what he'd done. And a few weeks later, he was saying to his counsellors, none of you can manage things the way Cromwell could. And I think that was the key, because Cromwell was omnicompetent. There was nothing in government he wouldn't tackle, and nothing he wouldn't take on as a man. He had a huge appetite for life. He was very smart, and he was the kind of man who sees the big picture but takes care of the details as well. Now, if a king's got a servant like that, he's as well to look after him. But this is Henry we're talking about. He's open to influence and persuasion. And there's a moment when Cromwell is off balance because things are running against him. And Cromwell's enemies take advantage of that to get to Henry, put on a united front. And the king wavers just long enough for him to be arrested and executed.
So it was almost an accident.
I would say that the manner of it was incidental. It happened then, it could have been other times, there could have been other proximate causes. But I think there's a problem written into the whole Cromwell project. There's a flaw there right at the start. He's a man whose career is totally dependent on the king. He's a man from nowhere. He's a blacksmith's son. So, as one of the characters says to him, everything for you depends on the next beat of the king's heart. Everything you have comes from the king, and hangs on his favour. Now, that makes him unlike Henry's other courtiers, who were landed gentlemen, who have their own tenantry, their own households, great families, and a long pedigree. So they are kind of written into the structure of England, into the hierarchy. And Cromwell isn't. And that's a weakness, which was not in any way his fault. But as you watch his career, you think, well, he's climbing and climbing this ladder, but there's no point of stability. So I think his eventual fall was inevitable, but there was always the possibility that he might outlive Henry and then he would become advisor to Henry's little son.
I kept on engaging in that kind of magical thinking that, yeah, even though I knew the outcome, I kept thinking, well, why couldn't his son Gregory's wife, who was the sister of the dead Queen Jane, why couldn't she help?
Well, the point was for the family of someone accused of treason. They had to say the right thing to the king, or they would go under as well. Because when someone was convicted of treason, then everything they had was confiscated, and that included the possessions of their heirs. So Cromwell's idea would have been that Elizabeth Seymour should do exactly what she did. Mm. She would say, Majesty, we hope you can forgive us for being related to this traitor, and thus distance herself. I don't think there was any plea that Elizabeth could have made that would have saved him. Henry would hate to be thought susceptible to the word of a woman. So Elizabeth did the smartest thing for her family. They preserved themselves. And then the king, when he was sorry for what he'd done, he gave Gregory back his title of baron. And he gave him some of his father's possessions back. But being Henry, he kept most of it for himself.
There's something very... I mean, I suspect you hate these kind of parallels being drawn because they seem to be very contrived. But there is something very contemporary about the constant anxiety that everybody lives in. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I think that's right. It's not just the courtiers. It's everyone, really, in England at that time, in Europe. Life was short, and they were vulnerable to disease, to accidents. Medicine was fairly rudimentary compared to our own day. What Henry had given England, what the Tudors had given England, was 40 years of peace. There had been an expedition into France by Henry, but domestically there had been peace. And Henry's England was a young country. The infant mortality was decreasing. But then, periodically, during the 1520s, these dreadful summer epidemics came and swept through England and carried off the young people, not the old ones. So, yes, precarious. Whether you were a courtier or not.
I'm not going to comment on the strange synchronicity of the plague that we seem to be facing at the moment.
Yes, well, you know, you have this situation as well with the plague in London when Jane Seymour's become queen, but they can't crown her because they don't want any crowds to gather. Mm. And it gets put off and put off. and the plague goes away, but then Jane goes away too, rather sadly.
There's a moment when Thomas Cromwell is faced with the accusations and the insinuations, and he says, they are rewriting my life. Did you feel, I know that you have in some way salvaged Thomas Cromwell from the stereotype, but do you feel as if you are rewriting his life?
I think that he was a man who grabbed the pen for himself, and instead of accepting his station in life, growing up to be like his father, he wrote himself a new fate. But then when he comes to the end of his life, he realizes that all his actions have been open to misinterpretation, and they have been misinterpreted. And I suppose those lines were a comment by me on the fact that I think that for many years now, historians have been getting him wrong. What they've been doing is rolling forward the same mistakes from book to book because they're not going back to the record. And they are writing with a kind of caricature in mind. So I think that the public image of Thomas Cromwell has moved very far from the man he really was. And I was trying to write a truer version. Not alone, though, because there have been a couple of biographies of him in recent years while I've been writing my trilogy that have done a great deal to salvage his reputation, if you like, to go back to the record, look at what really happened and start afresh, see him in a new light. So I've been one of the people who've done that, and I've been the one who's done it through fiction. And if you like, brought him into the light, put his name back into circulation.
Well, you certainly have, and in fact, you've made Wolf Hall itself, the seat of the Seymours in Wiltshire, into quite a centre of attention. They've discovered the original Tudor building, have they not?
Well, they are excavating foundations. They found all sorts of artefacts at Wolf Hall on that site going back to Roman times. So it's been a site of continuous occupation. The whole place is covered in archaeologists at the moment, and who knows what they'll find. But certainly they are finding the old Tudor palace under the building that's there now, and bits of Tudor walls still standing. And it's very exciting because Wolf Hall was falling into ruin. But now there's a new family in there. It's been inherited by three brothers and a sister who are the descendants of the Seymour family. And I've been lucky that the book's been able to serve them in a way. It's attracted attention to the hall. It brings public interest. It brings in local historians, archaeologists, and the place is revitalised. So I'm really pleased to have played a part in that. It is in such a beautiful part of the country. At the moment, there's not very much for the public to see. But I hope that one day it will take its place again in the history of England.
I suspect that David Starkey is going to be unimpressed with The Mirror and the Light, as he was unimpressed with your previous books, accusing you of historical perversion or perversion of historical facts. You've said
yes, I imagine he's going to be terribly unimpressed, but he can't help notice my sales.
Yes,
you've said. Which I think is the point.
You
that's
think
really at issue here?
Do you? History is a process. You've said not a locked box of facts. I mean, that sounds very shifty. That sounds as if we can see everything differently from generation to generation. Is it that shifty?
I don't think it's shifty. I think what I'm trying to combat is the assumption that there's this treasure box and only historians have the key. And what's in there is completely unchanging and unchangeable. The thing is, if you go back to the record and you ask a different question, a new and an original question, you will get something else out of the record. And a novelist can do that just as a historian can. And this is what has happened for Cromwell recently, because historians Tracy Borman and most recently Dermot McCullough have been back to the record and discovered a new version of the man. And they've both given their endorsement to Wolf Hall. So I don't think they feel I'm being shifty, but I think it can be seen as a form of revision or revisiting, which needed to take place.
I know that Dermot McCullough wrote a biography of Thomas Cromwell just a couple of years ago, and I read that you had given him the mirror and the light to check for historical facts before publication. Is that the case?
Yeah, I've worked with Dermot. We've done public events together. We've gone on the record discussing Thomas Cromwell while I've been writing my trilogy and he's been writing his biography. So when it came to finishing up the book, I thought, who knows most about Thomas Cromwell? Dermot McCullough. So he's the man, and he kindly offered to read it for the facts, not endorsing it as a literary work, but just comb through and see if he can detect any blunders, you know. So once I got the manuscript back from Dermot, I felt on firm ground. I mean, in every book of that size, and this happens to historians as well, there are going to be niggling little things that you notice usually after you've got the first edition in your hand. But I wanted to run it by someone who had the authority, and he very kindly did that job for me. And it is a job because, as you know, it's a pretty hefty book.
I do know. Much has been made of the heft of this book. Did it get out of your control, or did you always know that it was going to be very big?
It was very much under my control, I can say. I knew it was going to be a big book. I didn't want to sell the reader short on the complexity of the history or pretend that it was other than it was. But what I recommend to the reader is, if you look at the structure of the book, it has six parts, and all but the last section have three chapters within them. Each set of three is like a little book by itself. They work like little self-contained novels. And what I'd love if the reader would do is, if they just take one of those and take it slowly, so that you're not trying to gallop through the book, but live inside it. That's what I wanted. And I wanted to offer value for money. I'm asking my reader for a big commitment, but I hope I'm going to pay them back.
I'm talking to Hilary Mantel about her book, The Mirror and the Light. Is it true to say, or do you think it's cod psychology, that you were attracted to Cromwell because, as you mentioned earlier, he came from unpromising beginnings. You've described your own beginnings as, you know, northern, poor, a woman, the first in your family to go to university, an outsider in many ways.
You're not wrong. Of course, there are many other figures like that who might have come much closer to me that I would have chosen. I think it's a fact that it's easier for me to write about someone who has their way to make in life than it would be for me to write about a king or queen, someone born to power. I take a certain pleasure in watching Cromwell make his own rules and make his own luck. And in watching him grab the pen, because I feel that's what I've done. I don't go around cutting off people's heads. There is this one important distinction between the two of us.
Good to know. Why is it that Thomas Cromwell appeals to you so when, as we know, Margaret Thatcher, for example, did not? You broke your stride on the Mirror and the Light to write a short story collection called The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher. And the title story, of course, was the planned assassination by the IRA sniper, which caused a bit of a stir. But you could argue that Margaret Thatcher made her own rules. She broke through the ceiling.
I can't write about a Conservative any more than I can write about a king.
And Thomas Cromwell was not a Conservative?
I think he was a radical.
Uh-huh.
But in religion and in the way that he conceived of society as well. I mean, he was constrained within a very hierarchical social setup in a country that valued tradition more than change. But he did create an amazing amount of change in his 10 years in power.
So remind us of why Cromwell is such an important figure in the reign of Henry VIII.
Yeah, I think, well, you've hit it there. He's a vital figure. And he hadn't been seen. He, in fiction and drama, he's just a caricature. And by historians, well, he's a very difficult topic for a biographer. And he had been ill-served by his biographers. Partly because of his obscure early life, but also because of the scope of his work. And certainly for the last 4 years of his life, every day is some kind of crisis. And everything seems to happen at once. Now, if you're trying to set out your narrative history, that gives you a very hard task. So what biographers do generally is they just cut him up into topics. You know, you've got Cromwell and the church, Cromwell and finance, Cromwell and this and that. And the living man gets lost. And I thought, because we're going back before Dermot McCullough's book, I thought, well, maybe a biographer can't do it, but maybe a novelist can do better by this material, by trying to imagine his inner life. Just trying to imagine how the world looked through his eyes. So partly it was the attraction of having a different viewpoint to bring to this story that's been so often told. The story of Henry, his courtiers, his wife, his wives, it can hardly be bettered. It's certainly stranger than fiction, better than anything that you could make up. But you need a unique angle on it, and I think I had that. It's the arc of his story. It's something universally recognised. This climb from out of the shadows into the sunlight to the heights of power, influence and wealth, and then a sudden plunge down into the shadows again.
When one takes a step backwards from the contortions of the story, you have to come to the conclusion that Henry VIII must have been stark raving bonkers, right? Or did he genuinely believe that Catherine of Aragon, for example, couldn't give him a son because she'd previously been with his brother Arthur's wife? Did he genuinely believe that Anne Boleyn had, you know, had affairs with all those people? Or did he just make it up because it suited him?
He's a desperately complex character. He's a very intelligent man. He was a man who, in some directions, was extremely stubborn. And I think that in Catherine's case, once having given this in public as his reason, he was probably too proud to retract it. And what he was maintaining was that he had displeased God by transgressing a fundamental law in the Bible. Now, Henry did believe in God. He believed it with all his heart and soul. And he also thought God was taking a personal interest in him because he does take an interest in kings. I'm inclined to think that it was a case of having made that statement and not being able to back away from it. However, his desire for a son, I think it wasn't simply an egotistical matter, as it would be with a modern man. It was a vital matter of state. And I think that what he was asking for, and people often lose sight of this, was not anything outrageous at all. Because in similar circumstances and in recent years, kings had been granted annulments so that they could have a second go with another lady. And this had happened in Catherine's own family. And normally it's the kind of request the Pope would have said yes to, coming from a king. But circumstances were such that the Pope was in the power of Catherine's relatives. So the international situation was against Henry. With Anne Boleyn, the accusations levelled against her were outrageous, and it's very hard to see how Henry could have believed them rationally. But he wasn't a particularly rational man. And I think he worked himself into a state of high emotion. And I think he believed them for just long enough. And what I show at the beginning of the Mirror and the Light is he's not exactly racked by remorse, but he is absolutely persecuted by self-doubt. And he asks Cromwell, did I do the right thing? And he's in danger of becoming admired in this. Cromwell says to him, you've got to go forward. It's the only direction that God permits. But obviously, he feels at the beginning of the third book that the ground is falling away from under his feet. So, in the silence of the night, Henry's going to come to regret it, and he's going to question what he believed during those few weeks in the spring of 1536.
One of the poignant themes in this third book is, as Ambassador Chapuis says, Thomas Cromwell did his job too well on Anne Boleyn, and Henry would not forgive Cromwell for exposing him to ridicule in what was uncovered, the excesses of what was uncovered about Anne Boleyn. Lady Rochford says the same thing, that Cromwell showed Henry the treachery of his friends. And those things were unforgivable. What do you think, that that's a strong reason for Cromwell's demise?
I think it was something that probably worked away in Henry's mind. And 4 years were to pass before Cromwell came down. But I think there are injuries that go really deep into a person. And Henry was a man to brood. He couldn't move on in the way Cromwell could move on. And what had happened with Anne Boleyn was that she'd been accused of adultery, not just with anybody, but with men who were very close to the king. And Anne was reported to have said, in effect, that Henry was impotent, certainly that he was no good in bed. So this had come out in being spoken in the open court. And it seems to me that that would be hard for a man to get past. And then the fourth marriage, Henry can't consummate it. The question arises again. Is the king potent? And it must raise in Henry's mind this whole unsavoury topic. He thinks he's a very sensitive, he's a very thin-skinned man. And Henry fears that people are laughing at him behind his back, that they're talking about him behind his back, and he's right. And it's as if, really, the Anne Boleyn situation goes underground like some kind of sneaky fanged serpent. And 1540, there it is again, ready to bite.
Has writing this trilogy changed you? I mean, apart from 15 years always changes somebody to some extent, but has it changed the way you see things?
That's a good question. I think it's made me much more confident in my craft. I think it's made me more confident in my handling of historical sources. I've no doubt that it's the central project of my whole life, but I'm not really far enough on the other side of it to be able to get perspective yet. I can probably only tell you if it's changed me as I move away from it. I'm still, even though it's almost a year since I finished it, and I'm now moving into working on the theatre version, I am still a bit dazed.
I think that you're co-writing the theatre version with Ben Miles, who played Cromwell in the previous adaptation.
That's right. Mm. Yes, we decided we'd give it a go ourselves.
Did you feel under pressure for writing this book in terms of the television waiting for it so that they could do their adaptation as well?
Not really, no, because I formed a good relationship with Peter Kosminski, the director, and we've been constantly talking, just as I have to the people who have the rights for the theatre version, Playful Productions, and I've let them know at every stage where I was up to. And certainly Peter saw the scripts in draft stage so that he could begin to think who he's going to need, which characters come back from the earlier books and so on. So I've kept him informed, but I had to say I will not rush this for anybody. And that's been understood. My publishers have been very good. They said it's ready when it's ready. They've understood that it's no good spoiling a project for the sake of one publishing season. So the enormous pressure, it comes from within myself. It doesn't come from other people. And it's not been pressure to finish up. It's been pressure to bring it home in a worthy style so that the reader is sorrowful and satisfied and feels, well, maybe I'm going to miss Thomas Cromwell, but this has been a good story and I can read this story again. This is what I wanted to achieve.
So Mark Rylance, of course, played Cromwell in the television adaptation. He's genius.
Yes, indeed.
He's got that beautiful, beautiful face and that air of the street urchin at the same time. Is he going to play Cromwell in the adaptation of The Mirror and the Light?
I think that's everyone's sincere hope and wish. But I can't say to you that's a certainty because obviously much is going to depend on what he already is committed to and on getting the timing right for everyone. I think everyone would very much like to see Damian Lewis play Henry.
I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure, to tell you the truth. I'm not sure about Damian Lewis as Henry.
I think he brought out a certain side of Henry very strongly. Just as in the stage production, Nathaniel Parker did. They were two very different interpretations of Henry. And I think he's such a volatile man, you know. He's so many-sided and presents himself differently on different days. So I wouldn't like to choose between them. But certainly, I thought there were moments that Damien captured beautifully and they would sometimes drift into my mind when I was writing.
So do you think that this third part of the trilogy was affected, enhanced even, by the other streams of your story that have been in the theatre and television?
It wasn't that the actors came in and played the parts of the people I had in my head. It wasn't really as simple as that. But the answer is yes, because particularly by working with the actors on the stage production, by being in rehearsal, talking to the actors, I did learn a lot, and it refreshed my practice as a writer. And it was as if I had more strings to my bow then, because sometimes if problems in the novel seem very knotty, I'd say to myself, well, how would I do this if I were doing it for the stage? And it would just free up my thinking. So it was a great help. And it was wonderful to go in the rehearsal room and be in the position of someone who's learning new stuff every day, going back and being a beginner. And that's quite a rare thing at a late stage in your career. And I was aware of what a privilege it was.
I'm talking to Hilary Mantel about the third part of the Wolfhall trilogy. It's called The Mirror and the Light. Last year, there was a stoush over Shakespeare. And you are quoted as declaring that his plays are unsuitable as an exam subject.
Yes.
Which, you know, stirred up the hornet's nest. Why do you say that?
I think they're too good to be squashed into an exam syllabus. I think that they're meant to be alive and to be played at and to be acted in the real world and not cut up into question and answer. It's not that I'm undervaluing Shakespeare. I value him too much. And I want young people to have Shakespeare as a joy in their life and not as a task.
How would you do that then?
I would do it by taking, well, to be frank, I would take a lot of English literature out of the exam system. I don't think poetry is a suitable subject to sit exams on. I think it's for joy and it's for entertainment. But now we come to a big topic because, of course, it bears on the way education is organised. And I think, for what my opinion's worth, that childhood and youth is being ruined by over-examination, by the tyranny of exams, and that children are being processed as if they were on a factory conveyor belt. And I would like to see them have more time for play, whether it's for music, for drama, for art, for all those subjects. I'd just like them taken out of the syllabus.
As for you,
I'm wary of the minority view.
Well, you're probably going to be part of the syllabus if you're not already, are you not?
I don't think I am. I think it might be a bit lengthy and chewy for exams, but it's a terrible thought, really, that you might become someone's homework.
Yeah.
Yes. I have to think about that one, Kim.
And there is
you can't exactly stop it happening.
No, no, it's beyond your control now. Well, I'm happy to tell you that I predicted that your second Bring Up the Bodies in the trilogy would also win the Booker. And I'm happy to suggest that The Mirror and the Light might take a third Booker Prize. What do you think?
I almost daren't think about it. I managed to exclude all these considerations while I was writing. But of course, now that I've arrived at publication, people act as if I'd only written the third book in order to break this record. I mean, all I can really say is that if I do make it onto the shortlist, it will be very, very tense. Indeed, not just for me, but for my publishers and all the people behind the book. But you see, I have been a Booker judge, and having been on the inside of it helps me know that there's a large element of luck and happenstance here. It's to do with the dynamics of a panel, individual taste. It's impossible to call, and I cannot do a single thing about it. So this is a case where I can't write my own story. I'll just have to leave it to fate.
I can't remember who won when you were a Booker judge. Who was it?
Antonia Byatt. It was The Year of Possession.
Oh, that was a fantastic book.
1990, quite a long time ago now.
Yeah. But also a very big book, dare I say.
It was, yes. And a very unusual book as well because of the poetry she'd written. And it was a hard-fought year. You know, we had very prolonged discussions and complex discussions, but I was lucky because we were a panel who pulled together, we worked together. We all had strong individual views, but we didn't quarrel. And in the end, I think everyone felt that the winner had emerged by a fair process.
Your next projects, then, you're going to be working on the play associated with The Mirror and the Light. Do you have books up your sleeve?
I do, but they've been up that sleeve for a very long time, since before I started this project. So I have to go and shake them out now and see, is this something I want to go back to?
Are you going to be able to escape the Tudors?
I'm not for a long time. I mean, during the next couple of years, I think I will be wrapped up in this project. I mean, I always still have on hand, as well as the play, there will be a picture book. There will be a book of photographs associated with the Wolf Hall project. And I'm working on this book with Ben Miles, the actor who is also a keen photographer, and with his brother George Miles, who is a professional photographer. And we've been taking our pictures for 5 years now.
What have you been taking pictures of?
We've been taking pictures of places that Thomas Cromwell would have been or could have been, but as they are today. It's not making picturesque or nostalgic statements. We're not trying to exclude the modern world. We're trying to include it. We're trying to find that rough edge where the past and present rub up against each other. So we've done lots of pictures at Wolf Hall itself, around London, around the Tower of London. In fact, one of the photographs by Ben Miles forms the end papers of the novel. Just inside the cover, there's a spectacular black and white photograph of the Watergate at the Tower.
Oh, I wondered what that was. It's the, it's very kind of gloomy and ominous, isn't it?
That's, well, as it should be.
Yes.
Yes, that's one of Ben's pictures. And you see his brother George has taken the jacket photograph. So this is another project going on in the background. So certainly for the next 2 years, I'll be tied up with the Tudor projects. Perhaps it's wrong to try to look beyond that.
I feel obliged to ask you if you have any views on the current state of the royal family.
I don't want to add to the gossip, and that's all it is, you know. The media have very few facts to go on.
The role of rumour remains now as it was in the 1500s.
Yes, and it's just a processing and regurgitation of rumour. And I frankly, I don't think any of us know what's going on with the young couple, but I think we should all just wish them well, assume they've got their reasons for doing what they're doing, and leave it at that, frankly. I don't know, you see, whether people at large in the country are as obsessed by this story as the media would like them to be, but they know what sells papers, and they know the power of the image, and they won't let it go. But actually, if you look at the content of these stories, there's very little there. It's all smoke and mirrors.
And that was Hilary Mantel. And that third part of the trilogy, the Wolf Hall trilogy, is called The Mirror and The Light.